As you look back, what would be the best time you think of the store and the money you enjoyed most? Was it the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the beginning of the 2000s? Is there a time?
Yes, I would say from about 2004 to about 2011, maybe in there. Those were some of our best years financially. And then toward the end, when all the competitors started opening again, it started turning back around on us. But those 7 years were really good for us. I was very conservative about leaving money inside the company, and that helped us get through these tough periods till the end of our lease.
But you said some of your competitors, then it started coming back around again?
Well, more of them started moving in toward the end, right before we closed.
And that affected your business?
Yes. It had a negative effect on us.
Talk about if you remember some of the prices from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and today. Like, do you remember vegetables, apples, or whatever you could say, well, they were priced at such and such back in the 60s, and today they're such and such?
That's hard for me to remember. I remember, though, that just in general terms, we had a lot of prices like 39 cents, 49 cents. This is back in the 60s. You know, on products.
Right.
You can't buy anything.
Can't buy
that.
A candy bar for
no,
that.
No. Well, in fact, a candy bar is like $1.19.
Yeah.
And John, they've shrunk in size.
Right.
You've noticed that.
Right.
So the prices have gone up dramatically. It seems to me I remember that you could buy a package of cigarettes for 30 cents. And we got out of that business, by the way, and I was proud of the fact we did.
When did you do that?
We got out around 2000. These tobacco companies were trying to call all the shots by coming in and saying, we'll pay you so much money, but we want this space and we want to do this and you have to do this promotion. I didn't like the idea of, I don't think cigarettes are a good thing. So I didn't like it anyway. And when they started doing all that, I thought, you know what? I'm going to quit this. We were the first grocery store in Tulsa to discontinue tobacco.
What percentage of your business do you think was tobacco?
It was very small, I have to be honest with you at that point. It was small. We had issues where minors were trying to purchase the cigarettes and those types of things. And I just thought, it's not worth it. So we got out of it. But I do remember, you know, like 30 cents, and I don't even know what a carton is today, but I think it's around $55 or $60 a carton for 10 packs.
Wow.
So cigarettes would be, what, $5 a pack at least, name brand. And back then in the old days, it was 30 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember that, and bacon was really cheap. Eggs were like 39 cents a dozen.
What about eggs today?
Well, there's so many different kinds of eggs today, as you know, but probably the cheapest eggs you can get for around a dollar, mm-hmm. I imagine.
You saw a lot of changes in the way products were produced. There's free-range chickens. There's all these categories for eggs and for the chicken itself that you saw come in over time.
Well, that's true, and that became an issue. And I remember that we went through a period of time, for instance, with veal. The public was concerned that these animals were being treated properly before they were killed. And I know that sounds kind of funny, but they were. So it was a matter of, how are these animals being treated? Are they being treated humanely? Are they being fed properly? And there are some unpleasantries involved in there that I won't get into. But that always seemed a bit strange to me because, I mean, in the end, the animals were going to be killed anyway. But that was a factor. And then with the free-range chickens, of course, the idea there was, and there's some validity to it, that the chickens were healthier if they were allowed to roam around and forage their own grain. You know, of course, that's more expensive if you're raising chickens to do that. But people will pay that higher price for that understanding. And then fish, for instance, that became a big deal, you know, wild caught versus farm raised. I was a big believer in that because the wild caught fish to me did taste better and seemed better. But today, that's a big thing. You walk into a fish market, people want to know, are these farm-raised salmon or are they wild-caught salmon?
Mm-hmm. And you never heard vegetables being organically grown in the 60s and 70s.
No one ever even talked about that. They were just carrots that came out of the ground.
You know? And they came right out of the ground, right?
But that became a huge thing.
Right.
And there again, there's some validity there to those concerns, I think.
That would have affected prices too.
Yes, absolutely. And I remember when the organics first came on the market, they did not look good. I could bring in organic apples and put them beside extra fancy Washington apples grown in orchards the conventional way, and those apples look beautiful. Then I'd bring in the organic apples. They look terrible, and they were higher priced. And I thought, how's this going to work? Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it didn't work very well. And then gradually, the organics became more competitive on price. They began to look better. And of course, that really made them take off.
What sort of items would be put out on impulse buying that worked for you every time?
I would say seasonal items. If you could get the right seasonal items and put those out, people would impulsively buy those. Like, I don't think anyone plans to make a St. Patrick's Day purchase. I mean, with some exceptions. And I married a good Irish girl, so we got a kick out of promoting St. Patrick's Day. You could do wonderful things in the bakery and shamrock plants and that kind of thing. And those were really impulse items. Same thing at Valentine's Day, which we saw growth in that holiday. Halloween, and I'm not just talking about candy for trick-or-treaters, but Halloween party favors and food items, decorated sugar cookies with black and orange and all that, goblins and the whole bit. Those are all impulse type items. Putting them out at the right time is the key. If you get them out at the right time, you might sell a ton of them. You get them out there too late or at the wrong time, you'll eat them.
Then there's a placement on the shelf too, isn't there? That's very important. Talk to us about the upper shelf, the lower shelf, and the middle shelf.
That's a debatable thing. You'll get arguments from people one way or the other. What's the most favorable position on this shelf? And a lot depends on the product, the location in the store overall. But for the most part, eye level is considered the top spot. And then you had what we call first position. So the bread companies were famous for paying retailers, and they used to pay us in the old days, we'll pay you so much money if we can be in first position. So in their mind, first position was the traditional shopping pattern would let you arrive at this position in the bread section first. And that's where they all wanted to be. They had their idea of what the traffic pattern was in the store, which wasn't too hard to figure out. So in their mind, this is first position. We want to be here. So vertically, I'm saying all up and down for the first 4 feet, that would be first position. And that's what they wanted. And some of them would pay for it. But for the most part, we always stuck to the idea that eye level merchandise, our fancier products, our higher margin products, we wanted at eye level. If you wanted to buy Campbell's tomato soup, for instance, which came in a 48-pack case, that was down on the bottom. You'd been down for that. But for my expensive bookbinder soup, that needed to be at eye level.
Was it fun for you to place something in the store at a certain aisle or whatever to see if it would be picked up? Hobby Lobby and David Green, I've interviewed him, and when he was a high schooler, he enjoyed, as he worked for TGNY, he could go in and just place things in certain areas as experiments just to see if people would buy it because it was in that position. You must have done some of that.
We did, and it was amazing how that makes a difference. It never ceased to amaze me. We would have a product that we felt was in the right spot, and then we would re-merchandise the store. Maybe we'd move the vegetables over one aisle or something. And all of a sudden, all these customers would say, I didn't know you had this. When did you get that? Oh, we've had that for years. Well, I never saw it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. So it is a huge factor.
But everybody has their routine, don't they? and you were trying to break some of that routine a little bit. I suppose that also if you moved something, they'd complain.
Yes, they would. In fact, more often we got the complaint.
Right.
Why'd you move it? I got used to it being here.
Music in the store. That wasn't always. There was a point that that became popular in grocery stores, and I suppose in your store as well. And what did that contribute to even sales?
That's very difficult to say. For years, we were a customer of Muzak, and that was what they used to call the elevator music. You had an antenna on top of the store and a receiver and an amplifier inside the store, and you'd broadcast that music in the store, and they gave you like five or six choices of the type of music you wanted. I'm kind of a conservative guy, so I always put the old stuff in. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I think it puts people in a better frame of mind, maybe. If you walk in a store and you don't hear anything, it's sort of eerily silent sometimes, especially when it's not busy. I remember one time, John, and you'd appreciate this in your career, we got on the wrong side of the musicians union one time because I got the bright idea we were going to rebroadcast FM radio and quit paying for music. Somebody walked in the store and heard a commercial on one of the FM stations and realized we were doing that, and they called us to task on that. And of course, you legally aren't supposed to do that. So we went back to Muzak.